Welcome to our second lecture in our distinguished speaker series to do his undergraduate work at Cornell University and his graduate work at Princeton University, which he completed in 1966. Professor Hylas is a radio astronomer by trade. I should also mention that he has been at Berkeley ever since he completed his PhD, and he did spend some time at the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico, which is a radio telescope. And he's known worldwide for his expertise in understanding the interstellar medium, which is the gas that's between the stars. He's also well known for his work on understanding the magnetic fields, which are threaded throughout our galaxy. And Professor Hylas is a member of the National Academy of Science, a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and among various prizes and honors, he's received the distinguished and prestigious Danny Heinemann Prize of the American Astronomical Society and the American Institute of Physics. More recently, he received an honorary degree from Ohio University in Athens. So we're really very pleased to have him with us this evening to tell us about our local microcosmos.
Thank you, Sally. It's a real pleasure to be here. To be invited to give a public lecture at a great institution like this is an experience I've never had before, to tell the truth. So it's a new thing for me, and I hope it's not too disappointing for you. I was interested to hear Sally tell about the star viewing tonight. Maybe she didn't look up when she came in, but. I'm being a radio astronomer, usually I don't have to worry about such things, but I noticed, in fact, the students who took me out to dinner pointed out that it was getting cloudy. So we'll see what happens. Our local microcosmos. I chose this title because this series has to do with scales of the universe, and I thought, well, there's a lot of things going on fairly close to the sun, within a couple hundred parsecs of the sun, in my field of interstellar matter. And a lot of these things are brand new. In fact, the most recent one I'm going to tell you about is a paper that just came out last week. And I saw that and I thought, this is an ideal thing to put in this lecture because it shows that science evolves and our understanding about how things evolves. So I'm going to talk about the interstellar matter in and around the sun, not in and around the sun, but outside the solar system, some of which may be influenced by the solar system, because that's my interest, and it's also sort of in keeping with the idea of this lecture series, I think. So I'm going to talk about interstellar gas. And first, I want to give a brief introduction about the physics of interstellar gas, because that kind of helps you appreciate why we see what we see, or at least the possibilities of that exist given by the kind of physics that describe the interstellar gas. And it sounds simple at first. At first, we see there are three types of forces. There's gravity, there's pressure, and there's magnetic fields. And those are the three forces that govern what happens to any piece of gas. So let me illustrate a few of these forces. Here we see a picture of the Earth's atmosphere in which we have pressure and gravity in equilibrium. The gravity pulls down, the pressure pushes up, but with an exact equal force, and everything is nice and stable, and everything is fine, and this is what we call hydrostatic equilibrium. But it's not that simple all the time. Things aren't always in equilibrium, and things evolve dynamically to give us conditions in the gas that we would perhaps not have predicted or appreciated, and this is the result of the combination of dynamics, centrifugal force, gravity, and pressure. And so those three terms, those three things we talk about, pressure, gravity, and magnetic fields, they can be complicated. Now bring magnetic fields into the situation. They interact with an ionized gas. And we talk about magnetic fields, or we think of magnetic fields in terms of that great big red magnet up there. But those magnetic fields permeate astronomical objects, and they tie the field lines to the gas. You notice how this filamentary stuff in the gas follows the field lines that you know are connecting the north and south poles of that magnet. That magnet doesn't really exist underneath the sun. There's no iron underneath the sun that could possibly survive. It's too hot. So there aren't really magnets up there, but there are magnetic fields that extend deep down into the sun that are caused by the solar dynamo, which generates the magnetic field of the sun and causes sunspots. And that sunspot you see up there is just a place where it's one of the poles of this magnet. That's the sunspot. If you looked at it from on top, you'd see that. And that looks like a nice, stable situation, too. But what you have to realize is the north and south poles of that magnet want to attract each other, and when they do that, they're gradually moving together. They're kept apart by the pressure of the solar atmosphere. And occasionally, they actually do manage to come together, cause a solar flare, the positive and negative parts of the magnetic field annihilate, release a great big burst of energy, produce big showers of cosmic rays. Some of them occasionally cause electrical blackouts in our electrical system. The astronauts have to worry about these things, and they cause, back when I was a kid, you know, we relied on long-distance radio communication, and it would black out the long-distance radio communication. So these things can be serious. I want to illustrate magnetic forces with these couple of pipes, actually, and illustrate this concept of flux freezing, in which the magnetic field lines are tied to the gas and one can't move without the other moving along with it. When we talk of magnetic fields, we usually talk of magnets, and here are a couple of magnets. They're very powerful magnets, and I can barely get them apart. And this is what we usually think of when we talk about magnets. But let me show you another aspect of magnets. These pipes are large enough in diameter so that this magnet can go down them, like that. That's a PVC pipe. This is a copper pipe. Look at that. You know, copper is not magnetic. Whoops, there we go. Copper is not magnetic. So, you know, there's no magnetic force here. So what's going on? This is the concept of flux freezing. The magnetic lines in this magnet, when you drop the magnet down here, are inducing currents in this pipe. And the currents in the pipe's a very good conductor, tend themselves to produce another magnetic field which resists the dropping of the magnetic field of the magnet. And so you can think of this as the copper pipe wants to take the magnetic lines in this magnet and prevent them from moving with respect to the pipe. And if the pipe was a better conductor still, what would happen is I'd drop the magnet down here, and it would never fall out. It's a pretty good conductor, so it takes a while to fall out. So I'm going to pass this around, and you can play with it and make sure that I'm not pulling any wool over your eyes. And if you want to later, you can come up and do it with a smaller magnet just for fun. Anyway, it was a real fun thing to illustrate this magnetic force with a magnet acting on a non-magnetic material. Okay, so we've been talking about kind of things that are nice and smooth. The other thing that happens in hydrodynamics is turbulence. Any kayaker knows that, and that can be a lot of fun, but it can also be a total mess for theorists and astronomers who deal with turbulence, because when those magnetic field lines are frozen in to the fluid, and the fluid moves in a turbulent way, the magnetic field gets turbulent, and you have this combination of gravity, pressure, and magnetic field that produces very complex phenomena that we actually do not understand, but I'll describe a little of the way that they look in real observations. So to introduce astronomy into this discussion, now we've been, get off the physics part, introduce astronomy in this discussion, I want to talk about nuclear bomb blasts. Nuclear bomb blasts, the equivalent on Earth of what goes on in interstellar space produced by supernovae. This is our own little mini supernova on the Earth, a picture published in Life magazine just after World War II. And the important thing about this picture, it gives the time after explosion, and it gives a distance scale. And I'll come back to that in a minute. Here's the equivalent of a nuclear explosion in interstellar space. This is called the Orion Eridanus supershell, or superbubble. Now, this is a big section of sky. This is the constellation of Orion. Now, you know how big that is on the sky. It's occupying an angle like this. This bubble here is caused, well, first of all, size-wise, it's 4 or 5 times as big as the constellation of Orion. So instead of being this big, it's like that big. It occupies an angle of about 30 degrees in the sky. What is this? Well, the green is neutral gas in the interstellar medium revealed by the 21-centimeter line, which we study with radio astronomy. And the green stuff is piled around here on the edges. It gets a little faint over here. But there, you notice there's no green here in the middle. In the middle, it's all blue. The blue is X-ray emission caused by very hot gas, about 1 million degrees, with a very high pressure that's evacuating. It's sweeping the gas out of this spherical cavity here, or not quite so spherical, and pushing the gas into these walls around the edge. And those walls around the edge contain the gas that used to lie in this region here that is now evacuated, except for the fact that it's full of 1 million-degree gas. And finally, on the inside of this green neutral gas, there's a little sort of inside onion skin shell of red gas, which is revealed by emission from ionized hydrogen called H-alpha emission. And this ionized gas here is basically the same stuff as this neutral gas here that was pushed out. It's just that instead of being neutral, it's ionized. And when astronomers see ionized gas, they always need to know what's the cause of ionization. And the cause of ionization is the light from these Orion stars that are located here that are very hot and produce lots of photons that ionize hydrogen that stream across this empty space and ionize the inside of the wall of the gas that was pushed out, the outer part being neutral, the inner part being ionized because of the photons that travel this several hundred parsec distance. So that is our own equivalent of the nuclear bomb. That's nature's equivalent of the nuclear bomb blast. Now, I want to do something that's totally forbidden in a public lecture, and that's show an equation. And so this is for, if you don't like equations, that's okay. This is for the physics and astronomy students in the audience, and also people who can maybe try to understand what this is about. So the way you can ask yourself, how does the size of this bubble behave with time? The bubble I showed, the Eridanus superbubble, is really big. It's hundreds of parsecs in diameter. And it got that way over millions of years. How do we know how that dependence goes? Well, we do that by the conservation of energy. We say the kinetic energy in the swept-up gas of the shell is proportional to the total energy release of the bomb, the supernova. That's the total energy release of the bomb. This is the mass that's swept up, and that's the velocity squared of it, so that's the kinetic energy. So it's this equation that describes the motion of the edge of the bubble. And that gives you this sort of complicated thing at the end. Well, you know, this physics is not very hard. And the reason it's not very hard is it doesn't include magnetic fields. It doesn't include gravity. It includes only pressure from the bomb, from the heated gas by the bomb. Well, a couple of guys named Sethoff in Russia and Taylor in England saw that Life magazine article, and they had a theory. They had already developed this theory. And so Taylor sent a letter to the editor of the London Times, not New York Times. The New York Times would have never published it, I'm sure. And he stated how much energy the bomb released. And you can imagine the political ramifications these days, which would have happened. It was even worse back then. That was back in the McCarthy times. Well, anyway, just to show that simple physics can describe the simple type of explosion we see with a nuclear bomb or a supernova. Now, here is another astronomically important supernova-induced result called the North Polar Spur. It's roughly in the opposite direction from the Eridanus superbubble. The Eridanus superbubble is over there towards Orion, and this one is over there towards the galactic center. And the angular scale here is even more extreme than the other. It's this big in diameter when you look at it carefully. The red is the, here is the neutral gas. The green is synchrotron radiation relative to electrons and magnetic field, and the blue is again the million degree gas, and the blue extends way down here too. This is a huge object. It's 120 degrees in diameter. 120 degrees in diameter. From there to there, the diameter is 180 degrees. So 120 degrees is from there to about there. And so if you could see this with your eyes, which you can't because it's only visible in the radio, it would be a circle that if it was over there on the horizon, touching the horizon, and it went up, it would go back around your head 30 degrees over and occupy this huge circle in the sky. It would be a truly spectacular object. Then you have to ask, for an object to subtend an angle of 120 degrees, and here I have to say I had another prop I was going to bring, which is a balloon, because I had a nice spherical balloon I was going to blow up and show you how close a spherical object has to be to subtend 120 degrees when you're looking at it. So I don't have a balloon, but I do have this little bottle of water. And here, the angle that is subtending is about 10 degrees. I bring it closer, it's about 30 degrees. I bring it closer yet, it's 50 degrees. To get 120 degrees, I got to put it right up against my nose. And now it's subtending about 120 degrees. That is the angle from there to there. And what that means is that this spherical or quasi-spherical supernova-induced supershell has its outer shell right up against our noses. And in fact, the gas, the interstellar gas that's flowing through the solar system is flowing from this direction, and it is the wall, the nearby wall of this expanding shell moving right through our solar system. So it's an important object in that way. It's nice to know about. I want to show you now another view of this object. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you a series of photographs made of the 21-centimeter line that's associated with this object. The field of view will be exactly the same. So the center of the object is about here. And this is going to be the 21-centimeter line seen at different Doppler velocities. And before I explain what it means, I'm going to show you what the data look like. This is These are data that are obtained by radio astronomy, obtained over this angle here. This angle here is 180 degrees by 180 degrees. And so what I hope you can see here is the fact these different frames are at different Doppler velocities, and it starts out large, and then in the next frame it gets smaller, and in the next frame it gets smaller yet, and smaller yet, and smaller yet. So as you change the Doppler velocity, the apparent size of this object is changing. Do you see that pattern in these data? I saw some people nod their head. That's good, because that means that maybe astronomers are not totally fooling themselves. So here's the explanation. The explanation is, okay, we're observing from over on this side. This is a spherical shell. It's expanding everywhere radially with some velocity. The amount of that velocity that we see as a Doppler shift depends only on the component of velocity towards us. You're familiar with the Doppler shift. You know, when you were a kid, you stood at a railroad crossing, and the train would come towards you with its horn blowing, and it would go, the tone would be higher when it's coming towards you, lower when it's going away from you, and that's called the Doppler effect. The faster it comes towards you, the higher the frequency shift. So here, on this part of the expanding shell, we're over here, it's coming directly towards us, so the frequency shift is high. The hydrogen here emitting the 21 centimeter line, we see a Doppler shifted to a higher frequency. Here on the edge of the shell, the hydrogen is moving perpendicular to us, and we see no Doppler shift because the velocity is perpendicular to our line of sight. And at other places along this shell, we see different Doppler shifts. Here we see something that's a little less than here. Here we see something that's a little less than there, and so forth. And the loci of the points that have this Doppler shift lies along this dashed line here. But this dashed line, remember, this is a sphere. And so the dashed line is a circle of diameter from here to here. So this Doppler velocity has this diameter. This Doppler velocity has a smaller diameter. And that's what you're seeing when you see this series of different diameters at different velocities in the 21 centimeter line. So that kind of maybe helps to bring home the point that this is truly an expanding bubble that is produced by something that has released a lot of energy, just like a nuclear bomb. And the thing that has released a lot of energy is a star cluster, the supernovae that were in a star cluster that was located here towards the center. That star cluster is called the Sco-Oef Association, and if you know your astronomy and your dark sky, you've undoubtedly seen the stars associated with that. And those stars, this thing is so big, it took more than one supernova. It took a dozen supernovae to make this thing. So these things where it takes more than one supernova, they're called supershells, as opposed to just ordinary supernova shells produced by a single star, because it takes a bunch of them. And since stars are born more or less at the same time in a cluster, and since massive stars don't last very long, they all tend to go off and blow their stack within a reasonably short time. And so their energies add as if it were a single explosion. Now, if that were to happen on the Earth, you know, instead of having a single nuclear bomb go off, but instead we had super bombs, clusters of nuclear bombs that go off, we could have not just a single bubble like that, we could have them going off simultaneously all over the Earth, and wouldn't it be a beautiful sight if you're Dr. Strangelove? Okay, so what does this have to do with magnetic fields? Well, let me show you a little bit about the magnetic field structure of our galaxy. So this is a, every one of these panels is a depiction of the entire sky. It's in a rectangular projection, which is a bit awkward, but nevertheless, it does show the entire sky. This is the galactic plane of the Milky Way running across the horizontally, and so it goes around 360 degrees. And this is the perpendicular to the galactic plane. So this is the latitude, this is the longitude. And these are stellar polarizations in which they look like iron filings. I'll show you a magnified view in a minute. And what they do is they trace the magnetic field lines in the galaxy. And these are different depictions of the 21-centimeter line, the same map that I showed you before, but now they're in color. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to blink one of these against this one to show you the correspondence, the remarkable correspondence between the structure of the interstellar magnetic field as revealed by the white filing, white, I like to call them iron filings, but that's not really what they are. But they do show these white things. They show the, they trace the magnetic field of the galaxy. And the colored image here traces the structure of the 21-centimeter line. And it doesn't take too much to realize that there's a great positive correlation between these. And this correlation is not just the large scale, like things like that. It extends down to small scales. You look at these things here, they're aligned with those filaments there. You can look over here, these little things are aligned with these filaments here. There's one that's aligned right there. The remarkable, it's remarkable how well they're aligned. So what does this say? This says that, okay, we've got interstellar gas out there. It's affected by the magnetic field. It's affected by the explosions of supernovae. And I also had a wonderful slide that shows it's affected by galactic gravity, but unfortunately that somehow got disappeared from my slideshow here. So this is what you get when you have all three forces working together, gravity, pressure, and magnetic field. You have these structures that tend to become filamentary in form, and they're fun to look at and fun to imagine about, but quite honestly, from the standpoint of the detailed physics, we don't really understand them all that well. But nevertheless, here they are in great glory. So I showed you two big supershells, one towards Orion, one towards the galactic center, that occupy huge angular sizes in the sky. When we look at these things from the standpoint of what we have in the galaxy and look down on our solar region, so here's the sun, and now we're talking here of a scale, this is about 1,000 parsecs. We have seven of these big supershells that are in our immediate vicinity, and maybe more. The galactic center is down that way. I want to concentrate on this one here, which isn't very big. It's about 100 parsecs in radius. It's called the local bubble. Our local bubble is defined by two types of observation. One type of observation is they can see the absorption of the swept up dense wall against background stars. So let me try to explain what we have here. The black represents the gas that was swept up by whatever produced the vacated bubble here in the middle, and the sun's here lying here in the middle. We live in the middle of this, and up until maybe last week, there was general agreement that it was full of million-degree gas, and that million-degree gas is of the exact same type that formed that pushed out the gas, swept up the gas in the Orion Eridanus super bubble and produced those dense walls. So this is a dense wall which we can see from the absorption lines against stars that lie beyond it. And stars that are closer than that dense wall, we see no absorption lines at all. Stars that are further away, we do see absorption lines. So we know that dense wall is there. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. And this is an approximate map of it as seen looking down, down on the sun. So the galactic plane here now is in the plane of the projecting screen, and we're looking down on it. Here's a side view. This one's in French, I guess because the French look at things from the side instead of on top in this particular case. Although the authors that produced the last one also produced this one. One of them is from France. So here's the sun. The galactic center here is now this direction. And this is the North Polar Spur bubble, which I showed. I think that this is the Eridanus bubble part of it, Orion-Eridanus superbubble. So this is the side view. And there's something very important here as compared to the previous one. In the previous one, the dark wall kind of extends all the way around. Yeah, there are a couple of holes in it, but they're kind of randomly placed. Basically, the dark wall of swept up matter covers the whole thing, and there are a few holes punched in it at various places. When we look at it from the side, we see something different. We see, okay, there's the dark wall here, there's the dark wall here, but on the top and bottom, there's no dark wall. Why is that? Well, that's because the galaxy is a spiral galaxy, and we live in a galactic disk. And this is I'll try to reproduce the slide that is missing from my talk. But basically, we live in a galactic disk. Here's the sun out here, and the local bubble has done this. It has completely blown away the gas that used to exist in the disk right around the sun. So that gas, instead of piling up in a dense shell here, it started moving up and it said, hey, there's nothing to stop me because up here there's no gas to stop me. So that we lost that gas. It's gone forever. And as a result, we have a direct connection to the halo of the galaxy caused by the explosion of what was probably lots of supernovae that produced the local bubble. So the local bubble is our local environment that we're hemmed in on one side in the galactic plane by a dense wall, but to the top and bottom of the galaxy, we're not hemmed in at all. We can see everything. They call this a chimney because the hot gas can go out of these dense walls like the hot smoke from a chimney. Okay, so we have this local bubble that's produced and made visible by the dense wall that we see, and there's no doubt about that. Let's take a look at some other contents of the local bubble, and I'm going to end up talking about three of them. From the early days of the first X-ray rockets, they saw X-rays coming from very hot gas, million-degree gas, and we knew that gas was close to the sun. We knew it was close to the sun because there are some opaque neutral gas structures that we knew were close to the sun. This is an image from the so-called ROSAT satellite of the X-rays, and you can see there's this sort of dark band down here, which is produced by a filament of neutral gas that lies in front of most of the X-ray emission. So here, outside of that filament, we got a lot of X-ray emission. And here in the filament, it absorbs all the X-ray emission from behind. And what's left from in front is the X-ray emission in the local bubble. So it's like this. Here's the sun. We got the local bubble here. It's full of this hot gas. There's a filament here that, and there's also a lot of X-ray emission coming from the galactic halo because it's also full of hot gas. And this absorbing filament will not let this halo X-ray emission through, and so what we see in the remaining path length must come from local hot gas. That's how we knew of the existence of the local hot gas. And these rockets went up first during the 1960s. And people like me have been brought up with the idea that the local bubble exists and it's been full of hot gas, and we've taught generations of graduate students this. And so it's well indoctrinated in the annals of astronomical science that this is what our local environment looks like. Well, here's a paper that came out the 14th of September. Now, that actually is more than a week ago. I said it was a week ago, so I lied to you. It's a couple weeks ago, or however long that was. But it's pretty recent, never mind. And I'm not going to ask you to read that, but the tenor of this paper is there's no hot gas in the local bubble. What they're saying is that the X-ray emission you see here in the filament doesn't come from hot gas in the local bubble. No, it comes from the interaction of the solar wind with the local interstellar medium, and it's a result of that interaction. It's called the solar heliopause. It has nothing to do with hot gas in the local bubble. It has everything to do with the very, very local thing of the solar wind hitting local interstellar gas, which is time variable, and they've measured that, and they went and correlated with the X-ray measurements and ROSAT and so forth. And these people, amazingly enough, are claiming that all of that emission that was ascribed to hot gas in the local bubble comes from this time-variable emission of the sun with its solar wind interacting with the local interstellar medium. So that's pretty amazing. And it's a lesson about what science is all about, you know. Science evolves. We discover things. We find something that doesn't fit with the facts. And then we realize, hey, we got to change our outlook. And it evolves in that way through a slow and tortuous path of experimenters and observers verifying the results of others and theorists making sure that everybody does things right. And that's scientific progress. And eventually, the truth is going to win out. And it's not possible for me to say that that paper is correct. Maybe it's correct, maybe it isn't. But we may find out someday, probably not too far from now, that that paper is correct or that it isn't correct. And that'll be a major, if it is correct, that's a major change in our view of our local microcosmos. If that does happen, you'll probably not read about it in the New York Times, because this is kind of probably a little too detailed for that kind of stuff. Okay, so that's one type of content of the interstellar local bubble. Now I want to talk about another one. Tiny, astronomically speaking, ionized blobs. The Earth is tiny, astronomical speaking. These blobs have sizes that are comparable to the Earth's diameter. They're ionized. They have a few electrons per cubic centimeter, up to 100. We're not sure. They may be overpressured. They may not be. Their distance is a few parsecs. These things are impossible to observe directly. And so how do we know of their existence? Well, we take two major telescopes in the world. The Australia Telescope Compact Array. Where is it located? Australia. The Very Large Array. Where is it located? New Mexico. They're located at different places on the Earth. separated by considerable path differences. Because they're interferometric, they can make very, very accurate measurements of the flux density of a source. That's the apparent brightness of a radio source. So here are some plots of the apparent brightness of a radio source called Parkes 0405 minus 38.5. That's not very important. What is important here is, first of all, the vertical scale, which runs from 1.6 to 2.2, meaning it represents a change of about 40% or so, meaning that as a function of time, the flux, the apparent brightness of that source is changing on scales of tens of percent. And with time, we're talking here of measuring in days. This is 2/10 of a day. 2/10 of a day is a few hours. And so these things are varying on a time scale of hours. This is the variations at the VLA. This is the variations in Australia. They look similar. But if you look carefully, this one, this peak is a little earlier than that one. Expand the scales a little bit, plot them on the same plot, and here the dark one is the VLA, and the crosses are what you see in Australia. The exact same behavior. So, okay, you say, well, of course, the source is varying. The source is varying, so of course you see the same behavior because they're both observing the same source. But if that's the case, how could there possibly be a time delay? The time delay here of about 10 minutes between VLA and Australia. Somebody set their clocks wrong? You plot that time delay as a function of time of year, and you get a very systematic term. This is the time delay in seconds versus the day of the year, that's 365 days. They only have 3 points, so, you know, these curves are theoretical extrapolations, but, you know, there's a very systematic trend of the time delay as a function of time of year. And what this means is that we're dealing with something which is just the same as the twinkling of a star. And the star twinkles because of what we call scintillation and scattering. Here's the source a long way away. Here's the Earth. These things caused intensity fluctuations. And when the Earth spins below that pattern of intensity fluctuations, first the VLA comes into view, then Australia comes into view. And that's responsible for the 10-minute time delay. It's a result of twinkling. And just as the Earth's atmosphere causes twinkling, and what that means is there are little turbulence elements of the Earth's atmosphere up there. These are turbulence elements of the local bubble gas that are causing this twinkling of these radio sources. And this is a theoretical model of the shape of the objects that are producing the twinkling. And these objects are located a few parsecs away from the Earth, sitting in the local bubble. Okay. More local bubble content. I want to talk to you about a paper-thin cloud. Well, it's not exactly paper-thin, but it's pretty thin. It has a thickness measured in astronomical units. An astronomical unit is the distance between the sun and the Earth, and it's a few thousand of those. And the size is about 100 times the thickness. So it has an aspect ratio that looks like this. How do we know about this? Well, we went down to Arecibo, 1,000-foot reflector, the largest in the world. And we have been doing there a map of the 21-centimeter line emission over the entire Arecibo sky. In order to do that, we are employing this brand new series of feeds that is now located at the focal point of this giant reflector. There are seven of these, and that means that we point in seven directions simultaneously. And it means we get information seven times faster than we would with a single one of these feeds. And up until a few years ago, that's all we had, was a single feed. Now we have seven, so we can do this mapping. It's going to take us about 5 years to do the entire Arecibo sky with these seven feeds. If we're going to do it with one feed, it'd take 35 years. That's prohibitive for me anyway. I'm not going to live that long. But now this makes it feasible. And so we're working away with primary people involved, a graduate student of mine named Josh Peek, and two professors, Snezna Stanimirovic at Wisconsin and Mary Putnam here from Michigan, who unfortunately isn't here tonight because she's off at an important international meeting to talk about some of this stuff. So this is kind of a technical slide which shows the emission from a particular place as a function of velocity. It's called a 21-centimeter line spectrum. The velocity scale is shown down here. It runs from minus 50 to plus 20 kilometers per second. And we see this emission over a wide range of velocities. We're looking towards an extragalactic radio source, which allows us to measure the absorption of this gas, of that radiation by this gas. And so we can plot not only the amount of emission from the gas, we can plot the absorption of the gas. And you notice this peak here has a lot more absorption relative to the other peaks than here. So it does a lot of absorbing, but not very much emitting. I don't want to go into the details, but this allows us to determine the temperature of the gas, which comes out to be 17 degrees Kelvin, which is very, really cold. And it also allows us to say something about the volume density of the cloud and something about the thickness of the cloud. And we can calculate how thick that cloud is. And the answer is, okay, the answer is I'm showing this cloud as a slab of length L along the line of sight. We're looking horizontally here. And I'm showing it as a slab because, which will become clear in a minute, it kind of looks like this sheet of paper. And so here, the sheet of paper sits in front of the slab. L is the length of the sheet of paper in this direction. And the sheet of paper extends up and down by a factor of 100 in each direction, larger than the thickness. The thickness, L, we can calculate a couple hundredths of a parsec, which is not very big in astronomical terms. And if that cloud were spherical, it would occupy a very tiny angle in the sky. But we can map that cloud at Arecibo. And here's the map. These numbers are degrees. It's about 10 degrees in length. And what that means is its linear scale is 5 to 10 parsecs, whereas the distance across it into the board is a couple hundredths of a parsec. And what that means is the aspect ratio, the thickness to the size, is like this sheet of paper. So this is that's why I call it a paper-thin cloud, because it's not really paper-thin, but it has the aspect ratio of a piece of paper. Let's see, I've lost track of what the next thing is. Oh, yes, I wanted to show how. Yeah, we want to determine where is this cloud? How close is it? The 21-centimeter line data themselves do not tell you how far away anything is. You look at this map that we made, and what you see is you see color, which indicates how fast it's moving. It indicates the Doppler velocity. The brightness indicates how much stuff there is along the line of sight. And that's what we get. The coordinates are angular coordinates. We have absolutely no idea how far away it is. In order to find out how far away it is, there's only one way, and that is we have to find a star that's beyond it and see if this object produces absorption in that starlight. And if we know the distance of the star, we know the object is closer than that star. And if we see a star that's closer than it, and this object does not produce an absorption line, then we know the object is further than that other star. So in this way, we can get the distance. And to do that, we have to look at these stars, and that's not too easy. We use two different telescopes in the world, Kitt Peak 2-meter with a very, very high spectral resolution, and I'll show you a spectrum there. And later we use the Keck 10-meter, has less resolution, it's colder, more desolate, no trees, but it's up there at 14,000 feet with a 10-meter telescope mirror, and that helps us get the photons. So here's the spectrum of that cloud in the optical from a star whose distance is 40 parsecs. 40 parsecs means it's inside the local bubble. This is in our neck of the woods. I'm not going to read you this or anything, but I just do want to point out that new Keck observations show a lower limit. That is, we've had a star that's 11 parsecs away that does not show that absorption line. And so we know that its distance is between 11 and 40 parsecs. So it's certainly within the local bubble. Now, if the local bubble has million-degree gas in it, it would be pretty surprising that here we have one of the coldest objects in the universe, 17 degrees, in direct contact with million-degree gas. On the other hand, maybe the local bubble doesn't have million-degree gas. One other thing. You look carefully at this cloud, you can see on this edge, the color changes a lot. There it's kind of blue, corresponding to that velocity. And over here it's purple, corresponding to that velocity. And over here it's yellow, corresponding to something over there. On this edge in particular, there's a lot of velocity variations. I don't have a scale up there, but the total range is a couple kilometers per second. Now, we got this paper-thin cloud, like this, and the Doppler shift is caused by motions along your line of sight, like this. And those motions are a couple of kilometers per second. How long is that cloud going to last before it moves a distance equal to its thickness? Because that is going to be a measurement of the time that that cloud can last before it starts to dissipate. Well, you know the velocities, you know the distances, so that's an easy calculation to make. And the answer is about 35,000 years. That's, I'm exaggerating a little, within the time of recorded human history. So that cloud is evolving in the time of recorded human history. What we should do is make an image in stone of that thing so that 35,000 years ago, somebody can look at it again and compare it and see how much it's moved. Now, we're not going to do that, partly because civilization may not last that long, and Arecibo may not last that long, and maybe the cloud won't last that long either. Okay, the last set of contents of the local bubble. I've talked about the million-degree gas. I've talked about these elusive turbulence elements that cause the twinkling. I've talked about this paper-thin neutral gas. They're all located in the local bubble. There's another set of fascinating objects that are very close to the sun. They lie from a couple to maybe 10 parsecs from the sun. And they have been mapped out by painstakingly looking at absorption lines from background stars. And this was done by Redfield and Linsky, a graduate student and his professor at Boulder, using dozens of nearby stars. And they found this remarkable set of distinct clouds, which I'll walk through. First of all, what are we looking at here? We're looking at the entire sky. This is the right ascension equator. This is declination. This runs the entire 360 degrees around the sky, and this runs the entire 180 degrees from one pole to the other. So this is the entire sky in a projection called the Mollywide projection, in which you really can't tell the shape of anything because this thing, this curved line here, is a line that runs from one pole to the other. It's a straight, great circle line. It has the same shape as this line here. So the only value in this projection is that it does show the whole sky. Clouds don't really have this shape. You have to kind of put them in some sensible projection to see what the shape really is. But this at least has the virtue of showing the clouds in the sky and how one relates to another. So this is cloud number one, we'll call it. There's cloud number two. Cloud number three. Cloud number four. Five. I mean, you get the idea. Most of our line of sight is filled with these clouds. That's a list of them. They're very well defined. Each is moving in a specific direction. And we have an interesting possibility when we look at these things. We have all these clouds. We have a lot of places where they interact, probably, where their boundaries are close to each other. And there's some thought that maybe some of these other objects that we see, the thin atomic paper-thin cloud, and those Earth diameter turbulence elements that produce the scintillation, there's some thought that maybe they occur at the boundaries of these clouds where these clouds are interacting. So I think that's the next step in this research, is to look for that kind of correlation. Are these phenomena, these other phenomena that lie within the local bubble, connected to the intersecting boundaries of these other clouds? Somehow, it wouldn't be too surprising to me, because it's what would be surprising to me is for that paper-thin cloud to be out there completely all alone, surrounded by million-degree gas, or surrounded by nothing, for that matter. But if it's related to other things that are intersecting, perhaps coming together and compressing and causing that thin sheet, that would make some sense. So, to summarize, we've talked about a number of aspects of our local microcosmos. We've talked about the seven big nearby superbubbles that lie within Linera's 500 parsecs. We looked in detail at two of those, the Orion-Eridanus superbubble, which is produced by the stars in the Orion Association, and the North Polar Spur stars, a superbubble, which is produced by the stars that used to be in the Scorpius-Ophiuchus Association. Those are major features on our sky that we can't see with our eyes. It's such a shame. But actually, I was talking with Sally today about the possibility of projecting those on the planetarium dome. So we'll see if we can't arrange that. That would be really fun to do. We talked about the local bubble, whose walls are very clearly defined and whose interior X-ray emission from hot gas was very clearly defined until 2 weeks ago. That's a slight exaggeration, because there was some thought that maybe this was going on, and one of the authors of that paper wrote a paper several years ago pointing out that perhaps some of the X-ray emission came from the solar wind interacting with the local ISM. But these other new people are saying all of it does. We've seen interstellar twinkling produced by scale sizes of the Earth's diameter that lie a few parsecs away from the sun. We've seen a paper-thin neutral cloud that lies about 20 parsecs away from the sun. And we see these 9 warm clouds that seem to be interacting, and we have a suspicion that where their boundaries come together, interesting things may be going on, like producing the twinkling and producing the paper-thin clouds. So the basic message of science: we're not unique. Everything around us is completely representative of everywhere else. We are not the center of the universe. Rather, we're just off in some place, and the part of the universe we see is representative of that elsewhere. So we see these structures, and they must be common. They must exist everywhere. We can only see them here because they're so close. But we know they must exist everywhere, and it's remarkable when you have been in this business as long as I have, you start looking nearby and you see things that you never would have dreamed exist. And there's one other thing I should say. We're living in a small part of the universe. We can only, you know, the part of the universe that's really close to us is really a small fraction of it. And so there may be other types of exotic objects that don't happen to lie near us that we see, but do exist, and we don't know about them. It'll be a long time before we can actually kind of be able to look at objects of this nature that are further away and do a better survey of the kind of exotic objects that live in the universe. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Professor Hylas, for a fascinating description of our local neighborhood. And Professor Hylas, we'll take a few questions now. Would you please repeat the question?
Sure. The good question. The question is, do the stars move coherently with the interstellar gas? And there are 2 levels to that answer. One is, of course, stars are made from the interstellar gas. So stars that are recently made from the interstellar gas are located and move together with the clouds that in which they were born. But eventually, velocity dispersion will cause the interstellar gas and the stars to move apart. And once that happens, there's no relation between the stars and the gas because they move independently. And a little, you know, it's like throwing a pebble through the air. The pebble doesn't affect the motion of the air. Then the other exception to that is when a supernova or a series of supernova go off, because then so much energy is released that it really does affect the way the gas moves. But then, of course, it's not a star anymore after it becomes a supernova. Or, well, it might be a star, but not what we think of as a whole bunch of stars that are moving together with the gas. So there are those 2 times in stellar life when there is interaction, at the birth and at the death. And that's the only time. Yes.
Ke versus 1.4 times the total energy. Where did the extra energy come from?
So I wondered if anybody would catch that 1.4. So you were really paying attention. So let's go back to that a minute. Whoops, I gotta go. It's not too much here. Okay, so what he's asking, I'm saying, okay, the kinetic energy is a certain fraction of the total energy, I said. So, you know, you got the total energy, so the kinetic energy has to be less than the total energy. But this, what do I have here? This says, I got to use the green one because it's important. This says the kinetic energy is more than the total energy. And you know, what's wrong with this guy? So what's going on is that this radius here is the outer radius of the shell. And the shell has some width, and in fact has a well-defined density profile behind. And the gas behind the shell is moving more slowly than the shell itself. So it's true, this is the total mass that resides in the shell, but most of that mass, but this velocity is the velocity of the outer part of the shell, and most of that mass is moving more slowly than that boundary is. And 1.4 is that factor that relates that. And the total kinetic energy is actually the mass times the velocity that mass is moving, not the velocity that this boundary is moving, and that's less than E. It's something like, I don't remember the number, it's something like of the order of 50%. So that's the answer to the question. But congratulations for noticing that. I was wondering, you know, is anybody going to see that? Yes. Yes. Okay, two questions. So the first question was, does the presence of hot gas in the local bubble, can that be related to dark matter in any way? I think that's sort of the basic sense of your question.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the answer to that is that this stuff is going away because of pressure in here. It's like when you take that supernova and let it go off, the hot gas inside is overpressured by a huge factor and is pushing this shock front out. And so here, that shock front runs into this decreasing density as it goes up, so the whole thing just shoots out. So that's a matter of pressure and also gravity, because the gravity is pulling this is keeping this layer there, but that's the only effect of the gravity, and the presence of dark matter is not going to affect the way this gas moves out. And similarly, I don't see how the presence of hot gas in the local bubble can be related to dark matter or not related in any way, although that doesn't mean that's only my limitation, but that's my guess, that there's no relation between that question and anything having to do with dark matter. Now, your second question was, oh yes, the North Polar Spur. So the North Polar Spur shell, or NPS shell, is like this, and the sun is like here, and it's coming through like this. So now, in fact, what's going on, you know, I've shown this as a nice, perfectly round, smooth curve, meaning there's no fluctuations, there's no structure. But one thing we know about the interstellar medium is it's full of structure. And so, in fact, the outside of this really looks nothing like this. There are lots of corrugations in it, and sometimes it moves further than it should. Sometimes it moves not so far. We see already the stuff moving through the solar system is coming from this direction. So it's already hitting us. It may not be hitting us with full force. That is, maybe it'll be denser in, you know, a few tens of thousands of years. But what that would do is it might increase the amount of X-ray emission caused by the solar wind hitting the so-called interstellar medium, or it might have some effect on the very outer reaches of the solar system in terms of cosmic ray interactions or solar wind interacting with the interstellar medium. But as far as we on Earth go, we won't notice it at all. One reason we won't notice it is, first of all, its density is so small that it would never have any effect on the Earth's atmosphere, even if it got here. But the other point is that the solar wind does interact with the local interstellar medium and does, in essence, protect us from a lot of that effect. So the local interstellar medium does come through. It hits this shock front and slows way down and comes through here subsonically. So its effect is ameliorated by the interaction of the solar wind at the heliopause there. Okay. So the question was, when you determine distances to stars or galaxies, you measure their brightness and you correct for the amount of dust in between us and them. And the question is, does the presence of the buildup of the matter on the edge of our local bubble affect that process? Because that matter has dust in it and it's absorbing starlight. And I think the answer to that question is that when we look at a star to measure its distance, we measure its color and its spectrum. And so by doing that, we can measure the so-called reddening of the dust between it and us. And that is what we use to correct its distance. And the dust, we have no reason to think the dust in the wall of the local bubble differs at all from the other dust along the line of sight. So I don't think it would make much difference in those distance measurements. So the question is, I missed the last part. Maybe you had an idea that you were expressing.
No.
His question is, do I have any idea of how the paper-thin sheet was produced? And the answer is no. It's the coldest structure we have ever seen in atomic gas. Not in molecular gas, which is sometimes colder, but in atomic gas. There's no molecules in that gas. It's very thin. It looks very fragile. It looks like it has a short lifetime. It's not moving very fast. It appeals to me, the idea that it is the interface between some of these warm clouds that are close to the sun. But that's pure speculation, but worth pursuing, I think.
Okay. I know some of you still have some questions. All right, we'll take one more question.
What is around the bubble? Well, there are a couple levels to that. One, the bubble has pushed out. The bubble exists because the gas that was in the bubble is now lies in the walls. So outside the evacuated part of the bubble lies these walls. Now, the next part of your question, I think, is what lies outside the walls of the local bubble? And that's a much deeper question. We don't know the environment outside there, the immediate environment outside those walls. In some places, it's probably more million-degree gas. In some places, it's probably some of this warm gas like we see near the sun. That's probably it. But in other places, it may be not so much gas and mostly magnetic field that applies the pressure. But we don't know the answer to your question. At least I don't. Pardon? Oh, can it be vacuum? Well, the trouble with a vacuum is, as you've heard the expression, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. So if you have an interstellar gas and next to it is pure nothing, the gas will try to expand into there. So pure vacuum is hard to maintain. What could happen, though, is you could have, at least this is perhaps possible, you could have all the pressure supplied by magnetic field and no gas. Magnetic field and cosmic rays, actually, which I haven't mentioned. They could be supplying the pressure, and that would be essentially the equivalent of a vacuum, because the pressure would prevent other gas from expanding into there. So you could conceivably have pockets of magnetic field and cosmic rays that would, in essence, be a vacuum. So maybe you're right.
So we can see there are still quite a number of problems that Professor Hylas needs to solve. In the meantime, before we thank him, and for those the rest of you who do want to come down and talk to him, I know you're out there. If the sky is clear, there will be telescope observing over at Angel Hall and planetarium shows. The planetarium shows will take place regardless, and those of you who are interested in doing that, please gather in the lobby on that side, and the Student Astronomical Society will escort you there. In addition to that, I wanted to announce that on Wednesday, there will be a science cafe sponsored by the Exhibit Museum at 5:30 p.m. next Wednesday at Connor O'Neill's, where you can personally chat with physicist Aaron Pierce about dark matter. And then I finally wanted to remind you that 2 weeks from today, we will have the next lecture in this series given by our very own Professor Mario Matteo. And those of you who know him or have seen him or heard him know what a treat that's going to be. So thank you once again to all of you and to Professor Hylas.
Thank you. Oh, sure. Yeah.
I think this is how I was hoping I could get your autograph at least and I left the space on my notes.
Okay. It's not much of an autograph. You want it on here too?
Sure. How about knew your name? Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Yeah, good. Glad.
Thanks, Professor. Very enjoyable.
Thank you.
Are there any other structures that can cause twinkling other than that?
Oh, there are. You see all kinds of twinkling in the interstellar medium. This twinkling is special because it's so short in time scale and so powerful.
So it doesn't count for a lot of it.
Yeah, these structures are unusual, but twinkling is universal in the interstellar medium, and it's fascinating methods of analysis that I couldn't go into, but it's really cool stuff.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hey, nice to meet you. Kiwi Davis. I'm an astronomy grad student.
Uh-huh.
I enjoyed your talk yesterday as well.
Oh, good.
Can you explain the twinkling effect again? I don't quite follow the time delay.
Yeah. So what happens is, suppose you've got this screen, and you've got a star back here, and the screen has little areas of ionized gas that bend the light, and so sometimes they can focus. And you're here on the Earth, and you see that happen. And then you have things going on. The screen is moving, the source is moving, and the Earth is moving. So this screen produces some pattern back here. And the relative motion basically means that this pattern is moving with respect to the Earth, but not changing in shape all that fast, because this structure isn't changing with time very fast, and the relative distance here is pretty large. So kind of the geometry of the scattering situation isn't changing fast, but the whole pattern is moving.